All right. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. This is a listener-sponsored community radio station since 1960, and we're still in fundraising mode, and we're about to go into the next program real soon. But before we do that, why don't we hear this announcement here? Here we go.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance.
What are the connections between the misogyny-motivated Santa Barbara slayings, the so-called men's rights movement, and racist and sexist ideology of the far right? On Wednesday, June 4th, 9 to 11 p.m., join the Joy of Resistance as we speak with Mark Potok, Senior Fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate groups in the U.S., Loretta Ross of Sister Song, a woman of color reproductive justice collective, Catherine Cross, a blogger who writes on the ignored misogyny of racist hate groups, and Kate Tull, a media activist and collective member of the new viral Tumblr site, Women Who Refuse. That's Wednesday, June 4th, 9 to 11 p.m. here at WBAI. Keep listening, keep pledging, keep learning.
Government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Usually at this time, Off the Hook is on at 7 p.m. and at 8 p.m. usually is the PC show, the personal computer show. Both are preempted for today for another encore broadcast here at WBAI. So stay tuned for that. Keep it here. And if you haven't donated money before, please consider becoming a member of the station by calling 212-209-2950 or give to WBAI.org. Give the number to WBAI.org. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest and largest collection of public radio programming in the United States. And this is From the Vault, our weekly series that takes that history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the American Civil Rights Movement Freedom Rides that began in May of 1961.
The Freedom Ride then proceeded from Atlanta to Birmingham, and that, as everyone knows by now, is where they ran into their most serious violence. That was at Anniston, Alabama, which is a rest stop between Atlanta, Georgia, and Birmingham. The Greyhound bus had its tires slashed by hoodlums at Anniston. Then the hoodlums were there waiting for it in their cars, and they got out and with clubs and rocks broke the windows of the bus and threw a firebomb inside, which created a great deal of smoke and then burst into flames, and the bus was completely gutted and destroyed.
The Freedom Rides was an organized effort by civil rights activists who began riding interstate buses on May 4, 1961, to test two landmark Supreme Court rulings. 1960, Boynton versus the State of Virginia, which prohibited racial segregation in restaurants and waiting rooms of bus terminals that crossed state lines. And 1955's Sarah Keyes versus Carolina Coach Company, which outlawed discrimination in interstate bus travel. If I were to tell you that Henry David Thoreau played an important role in the Freedom Rides, you might ask me to check my historical timeline. But as you will hear in this program, no one event occurs in a vacuum. So let's connect some dots. The Freedom Rides of 1961 followed on the heels of the sit-in movement that began on February 1, 1960 at Woolworth Department Store in Greensboro, North Carolina. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, emerged from those first sit-ins to help coordinate the sit-in movement. The Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, helped organize and sponsor both the sit-in movement and the Freedom Rides. CORE was founded in 1941, inspired by Krishnalal Sridharani's 1939 book, War Without Violence, which outlined Gandhi's step-by-step methods for organizing people and mounting a nonviolent campaign. And Gandhi, in turn, was inspired by the writings of Henry David Thoreau. And there you have it, your connected dots, and there's your summer reading list. The point we want to make in today's program is that events don't happen in a vacuum. There's an interconnectedness between people and events that oftentimes is lost in the history books. What we find stunning about today's recording is that it gives us the individual's personal story and breathes life into what history books have as a collective description of the activists from both the sit-in movements and the Freedom Rides. In today's From the Vault, we embrace the historical continuum as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of those Freedom Rides and the courage it took for the individuals to join the campaign. We began with a 1961 recording of James Farmer right at the beginning of the campaign, one of the co-founders of CORE. He talks about the early nonviolent campaign that would permeate the civil rights movement led by the Big Six leaders: Dr. Martin Luther King, chairman of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, John Lewis, first president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Roy Wilkins, executive director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, labor leader A. Philip Randolph, executive director of the National Urban League, and the sixth leader, James Farmer. Here is Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Farmer, I believe you are the first national director of CORE. At least I don't remember any previous person with this title. Could you tell me something about your post?
Yes, well, this is the first time that CORE has had a national director. The office was reorganized. You see, within the past year and a half, CORE has undergone a great growth, largely as a result of the student sit-in movement in the South. And because of that growth, it was necessary to consider the organizational problems of the outfit. And as a result, we set up new titles, new divisions of responsibilities. And I was invited to join the staff as national director.
How long has CORE been in existence now?
Well, CORE was founded in 1942 in Chicago, so it's 19 years old.
And how many branches have you now?
We have 50 local chapters scattered throughout the country.
Well, isn't that a pretty rapid growth? It seems to me that it wasn't anywhere nearly that many not too long ago.
Oh, yes. Within the past 2 years, most of CORE's growth has taken place. I would say that when CORE was founded back in 1942, Mrs. Thompson, nonviolence was not very well known, not well respected, and there had been very little experimentation along those lines. However, in 1956, with the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama under the leadership of Martin Luther King, nonviolence came much more into prominence. And it was then that CORE's great growth began, and that growth was even more accelerated by the Southern Student Sit-In Movement, which began a year ago, February.
I believe you have just been involved in this cross-country bus ride. Now, I'm sorry to admit that I haven't really had time to follow up this story, and you can begin at the beginning and tell me what the purpose was and how many people were involved and so on.
Well, very gladly, Ms. Thompson. Of course, Freedom Ride is now a part of American history, and I think that all persons in the country, all citizens, should be aware of it. You see, back in 1946, the United States Supreme Court, in the Irene Morgan case, ruled that there could be no segregation of interstate passengers on buses. More recently, in 1960, the Supreme Court ruled in the Boynton case that there must be no discrimination or segregation of interstate passengers in any of the facilities at bus terminals. It was therefore following up on these two rulings that CORE decided upon its Freedom Ride, whereby an interracial group from all over the country, at least half of them being from the South, would travel as interstate passengers by regular interstate carriers, Greyhound and Trailways, through the South, including the Deep South, refusing to submit to the local customs of segregation, seeking unsegregated seating on buses, seeking use of all the bus terminal and rest stop facilities en route, including the waiting rooms, the lunch counters, restaurants, washrooms, and so forth.
Well, now tell me, how many of you went, where did it start from, and what sort of thing happened?
Well, we started from Washington, D.C. on May 4th, after 2.5 days of preparation and training for the trip in Washington. In this 2.5 days which preceded the ride, we discussed the purposes and philosophy of the Freedom Ride. I could state that purpose very simply, I think, by stating that we felt that there's a long step between the establishment of good laws or the issuing of Supreme Court rulings on one hand and the enforcement of those laws or those decisions on the other. And so the purpose of the Freedom Ride was to seek enforcement of the anti-segregation laws and rulings of the federal government, and to urge people, Negro and white, when they're traveling as interstate passengers, to refuse to submit to local customs of segregation and to seek unsegregated use of all facilities, to encourage Negroes in the various communities through the South to do that, to encourage white people in traveling to do that, and also to turn the spotlight of public opinion throughout America on the issue of segregation in the Deep South, because it is our feeling that as much as we might like to do it, Alabama and Mississippi cannot be swept under the nation's rug. Now, we had 2.5 days of training. We anticipated all the things that might occur. We knew that there would probably be arrests, and we were prepared for arrests if they took place. The members of the Freedom Ride were pledged not to accept bail, but to stay in jail, not to pay fines if fined, but to serve their time, feeling that they could spotlight the issue much better in that way. We knew that there was a great possibility, if not a probability, of violence, and we were prepared for that too. We left on May 4th, boarding 6 people boarding Greyhound and 7 people boarding Trailways for Richmond, Virginia. From Richmond, we went to Petersburg and then Lynchburg, Virginia. And at each rest stop and at each terminal, we sent test groups of the Freedom Riders in to test the use of the facilities.
Yes.
Now, we found that throughout most of Virginia, the signs had been removed. That is, the 4 colored and 4 white signs. In some places, the signs were still up. In still others, they were up, but an attempt had been made to paint them out. That is, one stroke of the brush, the signs were still visible, but they had made an effort to paint them out. We found also that where Negroes insisted upon being unsegregated, insisted upon using the previously 4 white waiting rooms and facilities, they could do so. But by and large, they were not insisting upon it, but by force of habit or out of fear, were using the previously segregated facilities. A sort of de facto segregation existed there. However, in one rest stop, Danville, Virginia, we found that the Negroes in the group were readily served at the lunch counter in the white waiting room, but white members of the group were refused service by the manager in the Negro waiting room. The manager went over and talked to them and told them that they would have to go into the other side to get service. They asked why. He said it's a local custom. They told him they thought the Supreme Court had cleared all this up. No, indeed, said he, this is a local custom and we won't serve you here. Well, they refused to move. He asked for their names and they asked for his, and he finally had them served. But that was Virginia. And if I may go on, from there we went to North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, and Charlotte. In Charlotte we had our first arrest. We had not expected any arrests that early in the trip. We had thought we certainly would get to South Carolina, which is the gateway to the Deep South. But in Charlotte, we used all of the facilities, the waiting room, the lunch counters, the restaurant, and the washroom without difficulty. But one Negro Freedom Rider then went into the bus terminal barbershop and sought to get his shoes shined. And there he was refused. He asked to see the manager, and the manager came with 5 policemen. The young man was arrested. The charge was trespassing. It went to trial 2 days later, and he was acquitted. He was found not guilty on grounds of the Supreme Court decision banning discrimination in bus terminal facilities. Then, Ms. Thompson, we went on to South Carolina, and our first stop in South Carolina was Rock Hill. And at Rock Hill, our Greyhound bus contingent got off the bus at the terminal, and they found a little reception awaiting them on the part of local hoodlums. So a Negro and a white Freedom Rider tried to go into the white waiting room, and one hoodlum who was blocking the door said to the Negro, "The other side." And he replied, "I have a right to go in here," and proceeded to walk. He was then beaten by the hoodlum and one of the hoodlum's cohorts. He was slugged several times. The white freedom rider then stepped between the Negro and his attackers and absorbed the punishment himself. And he was attacked, and other hoodlums who were in the waiting room then rushed out and joined in the attack. One young white woman freedom rider was knocked down in the process. The white man freedom rider was also knocked down. At this point, but not before, the police intervened. Then from Rock Hill...
Were there any arrests in this case?
Well, the policemen were willing to make an arrest. They asked Albert Bigelow, the white freedom rider who had been knocked down, if he would press charges, and he said no, because he did not feel that this was the way to handle it. He was interested in talking with his assailant to see if he could not convince him of the wrongness of his thinking and his ways of action. The hoodlum who had attacked, however, refused to talk to him. And this brings us to an observation which I think is significant. We found it all through the ride, that the white freedom riders took more violence than the Negroes. The hoodlums attacked them with greater viciousness. This hoodlum then said to Albert Bigelow, "I would talk to the blacks before I would talk to you. I could kill you," because he was considered a traitor. From Rock Hill, after staying overnight there, we went to Sumter. En route to Sumter, there were two arrests at Winsboro, South Carolina, at the lunch counter in the white waiting room. One Negro and one white freedom rider were arrested. They were held for several hours, no charges, no formal charges, though it was rumored that the Negro was arrested for trespassing and the white arrested for interfering with an officer's performance of his duty. He had merely asked, "Where are you taking my friend? I'm traveling with him." They were released. That night, the Negro being released at 11 o'clock after the last bus had left town, and he was taken to the bus terminal and released, and he found a mob waiting for him there. So it was virtually by the skin of his teeth that he was able to get out of that situation. He found a Negro sitting in his car, whom he was able to pay to take him to a telephone. And the Negro took him to a Negro minister's home. He was then driven to Columbia, South Carolina, where he found overnight lodging, and by bus the next morning proceeded to join the rest of the Freedom Riders in Sumter, South Carolina. Sumter, there was no difficulty. We went through Georgia without incident. Augusta, Georgia, and Atlanta. I say without incident, but it ought to be pointed out that there were large crowds of people with hostile faces, faces filled with hate at each stop, waiting for us. But we used the facilities without difficulty. Well, in Atlanta, I unfortunately received word of my father's death. This was Sunday, May 14th, and had to board the first plane I could get to Washington, D.C., where he had died, for the funeral. I was in charge of the project of the Freedom Ride, and I designated another person to take over that responsibility for the rest of the ride. This person was a white member of the group, James Peck, from New York. The Freedom Ride then proceeded from Atlanta to Birmingham, and that, as everyone knows by now, is where they ran into their most serious violence.
This is where the bus was set on fire?
Yes, that was at Anniston, Alabama, which is a rest stop between Atlanta, Georgia, and Birmingham. The Greyhound bus had its tires slashed by hoodlums at Anniston, so that when the bus proceeded to leave Anniston, it got a very short distance before it had two flats, could proceed no further. Then the hoodlums were there waiting for it in their cars, and they got out and with clubs and rocks broke the windows of the bus and threw a firebomb inside, which created a great deal of smoke and then burst into flames, and the bus was completely gutted and destroyed. The passengers, including the Freedom Riders, scrambled out through the windows, and a policeman who was standing around merely fired one shot into the air at this point, claiming that that was to disperse the mob. This was after the damage had been done. Our contact in Birmingham, a Negro minister, Reverend Shuttlesworth, then dispatched several private automobiles from Birmingham to Anniston to pick up the Freedom Riders. This was, I should say, after they had been treated at the hospital for smoke inhalation and other minor injuries. Well, our second contingent of the Freedom Ride arrived in Anniston an hour or so later. And when the Freedom Riders got off the bus to test the terminal facilities, they found the facilities all locked up. They could not get in. They got back on the bus, and the bus driver then announced that the Greyhound bus which preceded them had been burned to the ground, and said he was not moving his bus until the, quote, niggers, unquote, get back into the back seats where they belong. The Negro Freedom Riders refused to move, and at that point, eight hoodlums, who had previously boarded the bus, got up and went to the front and beat the Negro passengers who were sitting up front. When two white Freedom Riders tried to protest, they too were beaten and were left lying on the floor of the bus in the aisle, and they reported to me by phone after the incident that they saw the Negro Freedom Riders being hurled bodily over them into the rear of the bus by the hoodlums. The bus then went to Birmingham. And what happened there is now an unfortunate page in history. They were met by a mob and were badly beaten. Jim Peck, whom I had left in charge of the Freedom Ride, he's a white man from New York. He was severely beaten, had to have 57 stitches taken in his face and head. Gashes all over his face and head from the beating. They beat him more mercilessly than they had beaten the Negroes. He says that as they had knocked him down and were kicking and slugging him with chains and with brass knucks as well as with bare fists, they were screaming, get him, Jesus, get him good. And he wound up in the hospital, of course, being treated.
But did this terminate the whole situation?
No.
Were there people left who could go on and proceed any further?
Well, the people who were beaten were, of course, hospitalized and treated. But their determination was to leave Birmingham and go as previously scheduled to Montgomery, then to Jackson, Mississippi, and on to New Orleans, arriving there on May 17th, which is incidentally the anniversary of the Supreme Court school desegregation decision. Well, the next day when they went to the bus terminal to board buses for Montgomery, they sat in the terminal for several hours waiting for the bus to leave. The bus would not leave because it was said by the company no driver would take the bus to Montgomery. They finally, since they couldn't get out and there was a mob of people waiting outside the terminal, they made reservations by plane for New Orleans and succeeded in getting to the airport and flying to New Orleans, bypassing Montgomery and Jackson, Mississippi, out of necessity. And in New Orleans on May 17th, the Freedom Ride culminated in a giant freedom rally at Negro Baptist Church, where there were several thousand people and hundreds of others in the street.
That was a clip from the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides from the vault of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Setting the stage for our presentation today about the rise and fall of black economic and political power in the United States. I'm Michael G. Haskins. One of the things that I'm really very passionate about is being able to tell our own stories. And the African-American experience is a unique one in this country. And I guess we don't find out about much of our history until we get a lot older. And then, because these things are not taught to us, we don't find out about our history in school because it's largely not talked about or not discussed, and only from one perspective. So we're here, many of us here at WBAI are here to correct that. And I have a very interesting film that we're going to talk about this morning. and offer for a pledge of support to WBAI. The name of the film is called Lessons of Haiti. Lessons of Haiti. And I have the filmmaker in studio with me, and I have one of the writers of the broadcast in studio with me. Ed Harris is the executive producer with Alva Pictures and Vision Corps Media Group. Ed is an award-winning documentary filmmaker who has over two decades of experience in television and production. And prior to joining the Alva Pictures, Ed was creative director and producer for Adhere Network. He was Reverend Sharpton's biographer from 1999 to 2006 and the director of operations for the African Heritage Network, where he produced weekly and monthly video promotional segments for off-network television programs. And also joining me in studio this morning is Byron Hunter, an award-winning film documentary filmmaker who has produced film and television for over 25 years. And I'd like to welcome you both to the broadcast. Thank you so much, Ed, and thank you so much, Byron, for being here this morning.
Oh, thanks, Michael G. How are you? Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
The Lessons of Haiti, this film that you and others, I'm sure, collaborated on. Ed, tell us a little bit about the film. We're going to go into the film and just give them a small sampling of it. So we wanted to ask you a little bit about the film and the idea behind it and how you came to the idea of talking about Haiti. I knew nothing about it until I first saw it. This is the second time second time you've been here in studio.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, yes. Good morning. The Lessons of Haiti is basically a documentary that tracks the rise and fall of Black economic power in America. And through a small annexation or small part of the town of the city of Durham in North Carolina, we were able to go back and trace a history of Black self-sufficient towns throughout America that started right around the mid-1800s and flourished for about 100 years or so. And they were systematically destroyed through a series of different things. First, it was just pure racial hatred. Then it was economic jealousy. And then lastly, it was the urban renewal move that happened as a result of Truman's 1949 Housing Act.
Yeah, the urban renewal portion of this is very, very interesting. As I'm watching the film, and as you will watch the film, I see things that happened within my own life, because I remember very clearly how the community that I grew up in, well, not that I grew up in, but I would visit, you know, I was born here in New Jersey and went down to Virginia every year to visit my family. This is a common theme.
Right.
1 year, there was this wonderful house that my aunt lived in, my cousins, and the next year or 2 years later, the house was gone, and this highway, I remember him talking about it, and the highway came through, and there was, my Aunt Maddie was given, I don't know how much money, but she was in another home.
Right.
But that big, wonderful home and that community, I remember that very well. I didn't, you know, I had forgotten about that kind of until I saw that in a film. So that is brought out in the film as well.
Right. And where was that in Virginia? Was that Jackson Ward?
No, it was in Norfolk, Virginia, actually.
Oh, okay, yes, yes.
Highway 64.
That's right.
Yeah, and it came right through there. And that whole area, entire area, was wiped out.
And actually, Norfolk was a mecca. It was one of the meccas of the Black existence in the United States at that particular time. So when you think about the significance of what you saw, it wasn't that you were just anywhere. You were in Norfolk. We actually had the privilege of filming, screening this film at Norfolk State University.
Yeah, I went to Norfolk.
And it was part of Tim Reed's festival. And then we were invited back, And it was a tremendous honor to speak to the people down there. And I have to really say hello to them, because the people in Norfolk were tremendously supportive of their film. And at the time they showed the documentary, they showed a documentary of exactly their town and how and what it looked like in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and what it is today, and how they're trying to rebuild it. So that's a very significant story.
I mean, you know, if we start going back and nostalgically looking at Norfolk, I mean, the whole Church Street, and it was maligned. I remember it being maligned, but that was such a vibrant area there.
Yeah, and what you find as you do more and more research, that this was happening all over. Now, we've only been able to document 100 or so cities or towns. There were probably 300-400 that we don't even know about yet that suffered the same history. And that speaks a lot to the whole idea of African-American empowerment in this country. And in light of the conversation that the president has been having about including African-Americans more in the economic landscape of America, this speaks a lot to what the issue is. We talk about, oh, there's crime in, you know, in Chirac. There's you know, crime in D.C. We're still having these urban problems. Well, a lot of this stems out of a basic neutering of the economic and social underpinnings of Black America.
And so this film starts out talking about the development in the Black community, in this particular Black community at that time. It was a vibrant community.
Yes.
But what it really speaks to is the development of Black America as a whole and what it represented, especially after the Civil War. You know, there's this preconception that after the Civil War, after being enslaved for 300 years, that we became this complacent, you know, fearful people. And no, what we did was we turned around and we built 100 independent Black towns. We built 75 historic Black colleges and universities, most of which are still standing to this day. And this was done within a period within 30, 40 years of the Emancipation Proclamation. If you go back and look at history to other peoples around the world, how many peoples have come out of 300 years of slavery and been able to build their own 100 towns within 40 years of that? So our accomplishments were beyond the reality of what a lot of people understand. And so when we think about how much has been taken away from us, that's a pretty free fall, sir. That's a pretty free fall.
Indeed. And we're going to go to an excerpt, the first excerpt of the Lessons of Haiti in just a moment. I want to let listeners know that are tuning in right now. That was the voice, by the way, of Byron Hunter, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, over 25 years of experience. And Ed Harris is the executive producer with Alva Pictures and Vision Corporation Media Group. And Ed is the filmmaker of The Lessons of Haiti. It has won 2 film festivals, and it has been the official selection for 4 festivals. Is that right, Ed?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really something. Byron and I were approached by, we won three. He just corrected me. we've been very fortunate. We were brought this project by a friend, Terry Boyd, who's the executive producer of the project.
Yeah, we shout out Terry Boyd, New York City.
Yeah, and Terry was actually watching a documentary about an American gangster named Frank Matthews. Mm-hmm. And for about 90 seconds, they mentioned this small town that he came from, named Haiti, where all these Black businesses, you know, Frank Matthews grew up in a situation where, you know, Blacks saw themselves as, you know, being able to accomplish things, and he was, surrounded by all this vibrant activity. And Terry took that little piece and brought it to Byron, and, you know, and brought it to me and sat down and was like, look, you know, I want to do a piece about this. Fortunately, I had already known the story. I'm a graduate of North Carolina Central University, that's right in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And so we were very familiar with the story, and we were able to go back and, you know, dig us some really good history. I remember you asked me a little earlier about the name Haiti. Mm-hmm. And how the name came about. On the earliest map we were able to find of Durham, I believe the map stated that a small annexation of the city of Durham was named Haiti. So it was actually named after Haiti. So we're talking about 1877, I believe it was. Somewhere around there. It's like 1877. So there was always this presence, this sort of black independent presence. And a lot of times, the name Haiti was used as representation of what took place in 1804, which was...
So this connection to Haiti,
yes.
The Republic of Haiti,
yes.
Is long and very, very strong.
Absolutely.
Yes, and actually, I believe, and if I'm not mistaken, there was a representation of Haiti or something of Haitian origin on the church, which was the first major African-American church in that area.
Yeah, it's an actual Haitian voodoo symbol on the steeple that's still there.
That's really incredible. The Lessons of Haiti. This is a historical documentary film that details the rise of black economic power that began in the United States during slavery and elevated following the Civil War, when over 100 independent, self-sufficient black towns and over 75 historical black colleges and universities were built within 40 years of Abraham Lincoln's signing of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1963. We're going to play an excerpt from the film and encourage you to call WBAI right now. That is making this possible, making this discussion possible. Most importantly, the film is a thank you gift to you for supporting us at the $100 level, The Lessons of Haiti, for a contribution of $100. The phone number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I looked on our website last night, and it is available online as well. It's give to, that's the numeral two, give to WBAI.org. Now I'm going to play an excerpt, and I hope that you will make the calls now. Ed Harris is in studio with me, along with Byron Hunter, and they've come to talk about the film and help me ask for your support, because it is fantastic that this film exists, but being able to broadcast this to you, to broadcast, to have this discussion, that is the most critical element in all of this.
Absolutely.
Because we can tell our own stories. How many of you knew about this? No doubt there are probably some that may be familiar with this. Some people that lived in that area may know about this. But I would venture, like myself, that you are hearing this for the first time. I'm not hearing about this for the very first time, but I, no doubt you may be hearing about this for the very first time. And you can do so because we're commercially free. Commercially free. That's the key. Because if we had commercial concerns, there would be no way that we would be able to do this. And I think everyone listening right now understands that. So The Lessons of Haiti, the film, the documentary film that we will send to you as a thank you gift for supporting us at the $100 level, an excellent instructional documentary film, a film presentation we share with you on WBAI at 99.5 FM. Thank you all for tuning in. The Lessons of Haiti.
Almost everyone in Durham, North Carolina is familiar with the names Fayetteville and Pettigrew Street. Here in the center of Negro Durham, more commonly called Haiti, the lifeblood of the community is represented in this busy populace. The world's largest Negro business is also represented in Haiti here at one of the 33 district offices of the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. The company has grown over a span of 50 years into a multi-million dollar enterprise. With this well-rounded variety of services and conveniences already established in Haiti, there should be no limit to the future development and progress of the community.
On Monday, January 21st, 2013, A day celebrating civil rights leader Martin Luther King's birthday, the world witnessed the second inauguration, Barack Hussein Obama as President of the United States of America. Following Obama's dominant victory in the 2012 U.S. presidential election over Republican rival Mitt Romney, it was immediately noted in the press that the overwhelming support of African Americans, who many Republicans felt would not come out to vote in the near record numbers they had in 2008, had been a decisive factor in the re-election of America's first black president. With President Obama's historic second term now underway, defining the current state of black political and economic power in America offers a number of interesting questions. Does Barack Obama's presidency mark the peak of black political power in the history of America? Will Obama's second term offer new opportunities for African-American growth in the global economy beyond Oprah Winfrey, Bob Johnson, and a handful of black corporate executives? Will we see future African-Americans ascend to major players in business like the late Reginald Lewis, founder of TLC Beatrice International? With African-Americans unemployed in the United States at a rate near double the national average, less political representation than shortly after the Civil War, and with no major black-owned companies in the Fortune 500 top businesses, the prospect of a new black economic and political resurgence doesn't appear to be on the horizon. But what has happened to black power and determination since the days of Martin Luther King and the years following the Civil Rights Movement? What is the true history of black political and economic power in America, and what has brought black America to its current state of turmoil? The questions are many, but some of the answers can be found in the complex history of a small community that once thrived just outside of Durham, North Carolina, that, like many other communities following the Civil War, saw its historic rise and dramatic fall over a period of less than 100 years. The Lessons of Hayti. The end of the American Civil War in 1865, a war that saw more than 620,000 Americans die and the end of slavery, marked a definitive turning point in the lives of African Americans, both slaves and free men.
I think that the roots of these community was the whole issue of self-emancipation. These are African American people, people of African descent, who chose not to be enslaved. Self-emancipated black people were not runaway slaves. They were people who purchased their freedom.
Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was signed 3 years earlier in 1862, helping the war effort by supplying the Union with 180,000 black troops.
This is something that Frederick Douglass had been harping on continually. You know, men of color to arms. Eventually, some 180-some thousand African Americans would participate in the Civil War, both in the Army and in the Navy, and certainly even as spies, you know, when you talk about the role of a Harriet Tubman during that time, because the Underground Railroad and those people who were operators on there, they knew the lay of the land. So the Union could bring them in and help them kind of move troops around. And Harriet Tubman was indispensable when it came to that.
Following the Union victory, the true challenges of American integration totally came to light during the post-war period called Reconstruction. At the end of the war, there were 4 million slaves, mainly in the South, and more than 250,000 free blacks. Within 2 years of the Civil War's end, a number of new laws passed by the Republican administration completely altered the power of blacks in the South. First, Congress temporarily suspended the rights to vote for 1,500 white men who had been Confederate officials and senior officers. Then, the Republican administration passed laws allowing all freedmen to vote, and by 1867, black men voted for the first time in the former Confederate states. By 1871, nearly 15% of all political office holders in the South were black, a larger portion than in 1990. To provide support for the former slaves who were now free citizens, many northern blacks moved to southern states to assist in the voting process and to help build independent black communities.
Blacks were like really excited at this period now in terms of the 13th, the 14th, the 15th Amendment. They have been passed. They have been voting ostensibly Republican. So the Southern, the Democrats in the South was concerned about those numbers that was going over. So now we get these troops out of here. We can begin to enforce some of those things we understand today in terms of voter suppression.
In the 1840s to 1870s, these were not threatening. After that, they were threatening. The whole notion of black people deciding to create their own spaces was enormously threatening.
In 1872, President Ulysses Grant became the first U.S. president to recognize an African-American governor, PBS Pinchback of Louisiana, and use military pressure to ensure that blacks were able to vote. Grant also consulted with black leaders, signed an equal rights bill for blacks in Washington, D.C., won passage of the 15th Amendment, giving blacks the right to vote, and signed the Civil Rights Act of 1875, giving access to public facilities, regardless of race.
Present difficulty in bringing all parts of the United States to a happy unity and love of country grows out of the prejudice to color. The prejudice is a senseless one, but it exists. President Ulysses S. Grant.
By 1877, only 10 years after black men were first allowed to vote, nearly 1,500 black men held political office in the United States. From 1870 to 1876 alone, black men made up a total of 633 state legislators, 15 U.S. congressmen, and 2 state senators.
Hiram Revels, U.S. Senator, Mississippi, elected in 1869 as the first African-American member of the Senate and the Congress overall.
Benjamin S. Turner, U.S. Representative, Alabama, served from March 1871 to March 1873.
Robert Carlos DeLarge, U.S. Representative, South Carolina, served from March 1871 to January 1873. Josiah T. Walls, U.S. Representative, Florida, a former slave that was forced to join the Confederate Army and was captured by the Union troops in 1862. Wall served as the sole representative from Florida from March 1871 to January 1873. Jefferson Franklin Long, U.S. Representative, Georgia, served from December 1870 to March 1871, filling a vacancy left by Representative Samuel Grove. Joseph Rainey, U.S. Representative, South Carolina, elected in 1869 as the first African-American member of the House of Representatives. Robert B. Elliott, U.S. Representative, South Carolina, served from March 1871 to November 1874. Later served as South Carolina's Attorney General from 1876 to 1877.
Joseph Rainey was born into slavery in 1832, but was freed in the 1840s when his father, a successful barber while a slave, purchased his family's freedom from their owners. In 1862, Rainey moved to Bermuda, where he became a wealthy and successful businessman. He returned to South Carolina in 1866 and was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1869. In May 1874, Rainey became the first African-American to preside over the House as Speaker pro tem. Hiram Rhodes Revels was an AME minister and brilliant orator who had been born a free man in Fayetteville, North Carolina, to free parents of African and European descent. During the Civil War, Revels organized 2 black Union regiments and fought himself in the Battle of Vicksburg. Revels' appointment as the first black to hold a seat in Congress was challenged by Southern Democrats, who questioned the citizenship of all blacks living in America. During his term in office, Revels fought vigorously for the civil rights of blacks against the violent actions of Southern whites.
The bitterness and hate created by the late civil strife would have been long since entirely obliterated were it not for some unprincipled men who would keep alive the bitterness of the past and inculcate a hatred between the races in order that they may aggrandize themselves by office and its emoluments to control my people, the effect of which is to degrade them.
The great irony of Hiram Rhodes Revel's historic ascent to political stardom was that his appointment gave him the Senate seat previously held by the legendary Jefferson Davis, former president of the Confederate States. The power struggle in the South for political control helped Southern blacks understand the importance of education as a prime tool for establishing both political and economic power for future generations. This understanding led to the creation of more than 70 historically black colleges and universities from 1865 through 1898, most of which are still in operation today.
And we're going to pause it right there. That is the first excerpt from the Lessons of Haiti, the Lessons of Haiti. And I have the filmmaker and writer on the film, the writer Byron Hunter, and the filmmaker Edward Harris Jr. And an interesting place to stop, or rather pause, right now. We're in the fundraising drive here at WBAI. As you know, we're raising funds to continue the broadcasting of this radio station. It's a 24-hour operation, 24 hours, 7 days a week. If you are listening right now and are kind of said, well, I didn't know any of that history, or I knew some of that history, we want you to get this. We have this as a thank you gift to you for supporting WBAI, the Lessons of Haiti, for a $100 contribution to WBAI. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. There are people at the call center standing by to take your calls now, and it's only going to take about 4 minutes to make that contribution. If you are rushing to get ready to leave the house, or just leaving work, you could be at work, you know, a postal worker, or someone working with the electrical company, and you're ending your shift right now or beginning your day, it doesn't matter. Just take a few moments and call WBAI, 212-209-2950. If you're not able to call, if you are working and your supervisor looks poorly upon you using the phone for outside business, pledge online at give2wbai.org. Give, that's the number 2, the numeral 2, wbai.org. The Lessons of Haiti, for a $100 pledge supporting WBAI so that we can continue this work in part. You know, there's so much that we've done last week and in the weeks past. Now, we're going to be doing some things differently in the days to come. Right at this very moment, on this day, we are offering the Lessons of Haiti for a $100 pledge to WBAI at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. We were talking off mic about the Northern blacks, as you heard in the film, the Northern blacks that moved to the South to aid in the effort of the building up of these 100 black towns. So, well, let's not say the 100, because, you know, they weren't 100 at the time, but to rebuild, to build these black towns. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, there was a move, you know, go westward, you know, going west and going into Oklahoma and Kansas, where it was sort of like this, you know, all this land was now available, and former slaves and Northern blacks that wanted to define their own space and have the ability to be men in their own space decided to go westward and go seek their fortune and build these towns. So all of the stuff that was learned during slavery, all of the building of basically the infrastructure of America that mm-hmm. we did as slaves, mm-hmm. we were able to then do and use for ourselves. And we built these towns.
From the ground up.
From the ground up. Mm-hmm. From the ground up. And these weren't lettered individuals. These weren't Ivy League trained individuals. These weren't psychologists and all that, that. You know, some of them were doctors, some of them were lawyers, but most of them were farmers, carpenters, people who could actually bring something to the building of a town. Mm. And, you know, that speaks volumes to the type of education that we have now, you know, and the lack of education that we have now.
Mm. And when you think about the development of these towns and you talk about the Northerners coming in, that's a tremendous bond amongst African-Americans that we haven't embraced either, is the mm-hmm. fact that the Northerners were the educators. They were the people who had already experienced colleges and schools, et cetera. So when the opportunity came, they risked going back down south or going down south because many of them had not even been down south mm-hmm. before. And although the Civil War was over, that doesn't mean that black people weren't still randomly shot in the street or that other things could happen to you. So it wasn't like a free ride going through the South, even though we had political power and we owned a lot of land. There was still a lot of vigilante justice. Because we didn't yet control the sheriff's department or the police department. So no matter how much power we had in certain areas, we still dealt with that situation. So when you think about the Northerners, these were people who said, we're going to risk our lives to go down to something that we know is an impoverished place. Mm-hmm. And we won't have the benefit of the luxuries we have in New York City or mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, et cetera. And we're going to build towns. That is a tremendous, you know, that's a life commitment. That's not, okay, I'll leave my job for 2 weeks and I'll come back. That's committing your life to another group of people that you don't even know and they don't know you, but they've been through, you know, slavery. So that's an incredible psychological situation.
Absolutely. And I don't want it lost on anyone, certainly not myself, that we're talking about Northern blacks. I mean, when we think about going down south, mm-hmm. our point of reference, because this is the age that we're in, we think of the 1960s and in that era and going back. But we're talking about Northern African Americans that went down south in the post-Civil War period.
That's right.
To help their cousins or people that they didn't even know.
Right. Because that's where the opportunity to build their own space existed. It wasn't in New York. You know, you had the race riots up here.
That's right.
You had, you know, so a lot of what, you know, and we're celebrating Malcolm X's birthday, which is, you know, I think so appropriate. You know, Malcolm's, one of his many famous lines was that if you're below the Canadian border, you're in the South.
You're in the South.
You know, and a lot of stuff that was happening here and in Poughkeepsie and different places in New York was happening in Mississippi as well. So when Kansas and Oklahoma and these other open areas were able to afford African Americans an opportunity to build their own space, then they came from the North, the South, and the East to, you know, have an opportunity to build their own. And, you know, I think that it's important, too, to point out that when they built these towns, Native Americans, Asians, Mexicans were all welcomed, and they were all milling and socializing amongst each other. Blacks were not segregated. We were dealing with the Native Americans mm-hmm. on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. We were dealing with the Mexicans and the Asians who were here building the railroads on a daily basis. So when, you know, it came time to, you know, lay back and have drinks or you wanted to go somewhere and eat, you went to the black side of town. That's where the food was, that's where the music was, and that's where you, regardless of your ethnicity, you could come and be treated like a human.
That's where the acceptance was, that's where the safety was.
Absolutely. And even to this day, you know, we have all cultures coming into our communities, and they're not coming in fearful. Mm-hmm. They don't come in and necessarily work with us, but they're all very comfortable in our community. So this, you know, so that's something that, you know, has been a layover. The only difference is now that the economic underpinnings that we once had mm-hmm. are gone.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the significance of Ulysses S. Grant and what his contribution was. I mean, we understand from history, you know, he's a warrior in the Civil War, a general in the Civil War. But talk about his significance as a president and what he was able to get passed and so on. Byron.
And I think it's important that people understand, and from the research that we did with the film to understand President Grant's influence, it's actually something that surprised me as well. But to give you a little bit of information on the president, President Grant came from abolitionist parents who were from the North. So he actually came from a system or from a situation where his father was someone who suffered because he fought for the freedom of blacks during slavery. So going into the Civil War, he was already someone who was aware and understanding of the plight of blacks, African Americans, and so he fought for that. His goal was to try to help win the war to end slavery. And I thought, you know, though it took him some time to grasp that completely, he wasn't as abolitionist as his father, it was very significant. One of the things Grant recognized, just like Lincoln recognized and wasn't discussed, was the fact that Grant knew that having fought the Confederates in the South, that once slavery was over, it wasn't going to stop the Confederate mentality from existing, and right. It wasn't going to stop Confederates from being Confederates. So he knew that no matter how long he sent troops down to the South to allow African Americans to vote, he knew that eventually he's not going to be in office. So he tried many ways to try to figure out how to give blacks some type of freedom, because he knew once you release these people back on black people without any federal support, it was going to be a bloodbath. So again, when we talk about the significance of that period, we have to talk about it wasn't just, okay, we're going to move out here and build our own. Shoot, the Klan was out there, whatever else was out there. So it wasn't like you just, you're going to find this mecca of, you know, bread and honey. So going back to Grant, it's important to understand that after the Civil War, he actually kind of to some extent was earned the respect that he had of all the slaves who loved him, mm-hmm. because of the fact that he had that mentality from the beginning. Once he got in office, he said, well, the best that I can do is I can make sure there are public facilities for all people in Washington,
D.C. He actually passed the first Civil Rights Act in 1875. So everything that blacks ended up fighting for in the mid-1950s to the 1960s, Grant had already established in 1875. 80 years before. So, you know, it begs the question. One of the things that, you know, I think was amazing about Grant is that very much to what Byron was saying, he knew that after him, what was coming. So he tried to establish an even playing ground using the bully pulpit of the presidency. Mm-hmm. And he was probably one of the last to do that on such a level for African Americans, you know, even for the White House to admit that this was something that was necessary is an amazing thing, because we have a black president now that doesn't necessarily think it's necessary enough to make executive decisions about, like, look, there's been a historical wrong here. So you had Lincoln admitted it, you had Grant that admitted it, and then of course the Tilden-Hayes compromise mm-hmm. is what dashed most of the hopes, but Grant recognized it. So, that begs the question, then 80 years later, what were we fighting for? If it was already established in 1875, what was the difference? You know, we believe that in a lot of ways it was somewhat of a red herring, because as we were marching for civil rights, they were tearing down black economic centers all over the country via the Housing Act that was signed in 1949.
Right. And we'll talk a little bit about that in this next hour. This next hour, I guarantee you, is going to move very, very quickly. We want you to make a contribution to WBAI to support this discussion, support the access to the information, because that's what this is all about. We're able to talk about the myriad of things that we talk about here. It's not this history, but this is a part of American history. This is the part of the American story. When you talk about the history of America, people like to look at the military conquest, the Iwo Jima and the raising of the flag. Well, yes, that it was significant. There's no question about that, and what happened in World War II, and that can be debated. But telling the history that we don't know, that is very much a part of the building of America, the building of the United States, is important to do. And we're able to do that because we have supporters like yourselves. Now, you support this radio station. You've supported this station for over 50 years, and kept the station listener-sponsored and commercially free. I'm asking you now to go to the phone, to pick up your phone and dial 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. The Lessons of Haiti. That's the documentary film that we will send you as a thank you gift for supporting WBAI. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the host of the program. We're going to take a break at the top of the hour to play the news, and then we will come back with more of the discussion with Byron Hunter. Byron Hunter is an award-winning documentary filmmaker with over 25 years of experience making documentary films. We'll ask him about that, as well as some of Ed Harris's other films. He is the executive director, the executive producer with Alva Pictures and Vision Corporation, an award-winning documentary filmmaker who himself has over two decades of experience in television and production. And we'll talk to them both about their films, their other projects. But we're talking about Haiti, the Lessons of Haiti. And it is for your study group. It is for the young people in your life. This is for your own education, to be able to share with others in your home, other family members have this, to be able to talk and foster discussion about what very well may have gone on in your life. As I was talking before with Ed and Byron, I remember the urban renewal in Norfolk, Virginia. And Norfolk was, it really was a hub of activity. Yes. I was there every year, every summer I was in Norfolk, and it helped shape me and my thinking. Because I got to see part of what that community was like, what a really rich and vibrant black community was like just before that urban renewal. It's certainly not the same now, no question about that. All right, so we're just shy of the top of the hour here on WBAI. The number is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950 for a $100 contribution. A $100 contribution, we will send you a thank you gift, The Lessons of Haiti. And it is an unflinchingly honest, in-depth, an unparalleled look at the rise and fall of black economic and political power post. And actually, does it predate the end of Civil War, this rise of black economic power? Could you, one of you, talk about that just before we reach the top of the hour?
It predates the Civil War.
Well, it actually goes back to the rise in black economic power began when slaves would take on jobs and buy themselves and their families out of slavery.
Right. They were the first entrepreneurs.
So we had entrepreneurs even during slavery who used the money to buy themselves freedom. And that happened thousands of times.
Yeah.
That independence, that entrepreneurship started even before the Emancipation Proclamation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, being able to tell young, especially African-American and Latino children, that this history existed, that this was actually something that was viable, that these towns existed. I think it changes how they see themselves in history, and it changes how they feel in history class when they're sitting in class.
The Lessons of Haiti, a $100 contribution here. Michael G. Haskins, I'm your host, and I want to thank you very much for tuning in.
To get governmental support at the international level against the injustices that they were experiencing back home. And as I said, the American Negro, or the Afro-American, who was in these various countries, some working for this government, some working for that government, some just in business, they were just socializing. They had turned their back on the cause over here. They were partying, you know. And when I went through one country in particular, I heard a lot of their complaints, and I didn't make any move on them. But when I got to another country, I found the Afro-Americans there were making the same complaints. And so we sat down and talked, and we organized a branch in this particular country, a branch of the OAA, of the OAAU, Organization of Afro-American Unity. And that one was the only one in existence at that time. And then during the summer, when I went back to Africa, I was able to, in each country that I had American community together and organize them and make them aware of their responsibility to those of us who are still here in the lion's den. And they began to do this quite well. And when I got to Paris and London, there are many Afro-Americans in Paris and many in London. And in November, we organized a group in Paris, and just within a very short time, they had grown into a well-organized unit, and they, in conjunction with the...
And, of course, Malcolm X, on this day, we pay honor and tribute to El-Hajj Malik al-Shabazz. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and we're in our fundraising drive. We're raising funds to sustain radio station WBAI 55 years. 55 years of commercial-free broadcasting, thanks to listeners just like you, that... The Voice of Malcolm X, we have a 6-CD box set that is available if you're interested. You can certainly call the number for that. Many people over the years have called in support of WBAI and have asked for that particular thank you gift, the speeches of Malcolm X, Prospects for Freedom. It's a 6-CD set. It's the debate that he had with students, Prospects for Freedom, The Ballot or the Bullet, and the last speech that you heard me playing parts of. I do encourage you to tune in later on in this evening for other programs that you'll hear here on 99.5 FM WBAI. But the main thing that we're doing is talking about this rich history, the history of African Americans. This is just a part of this history. We're talking about the post-Civil War period and the rise of black towns throughout America and the fall of those towns, the rise of the economic development in those towns and how that was undone. I have the filmmakers in the studio with me this morning. We're offering that as a pledge, as an inducement, as an encouragement to you to support WBAI this morning. The name of the film is The Lessons of Haiti. The Lessons of Haiti. We're going to talk with the filmmakers in just a moment. Edward Harris Jr., the executive producer with Alva Pictures and Vision Corporation Media Group, an award-winning documentary filmmaker with over two decades of experience in television and production. Byron Hunter is here in studio as well, an award-winning filmmaker with over 25 years of experience. And I'd like to welcome you back to this 7 o'clock hour of broadcast. And we're going to go back into the film. And, you know, we stopped right as just before Dr. Julianne Malveaux, who is also an educator and also is in this film along with Herb Boyd. And we're going to go back to this film right now, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more. But I want to play another excerpt for listeners this morning. The Lessons of Haiti. Now, this film is available for a $100 contribution to WBAI right now. It's about the rise and fall of black economic power in this country. It's not just one city. It's not just Rosewood, one or two towns, over 100 towns. So The Lessons of Haiti here on WBAI.
These colleges essentially produce the elite of the black community, the black middle class, if you would, both men and women, at places like Fisk and Atlanta University and Spelman and Bennett and Howard and Rust. These were organizations that produced our best and our brightest, our teachers, our nurses, our social workers, our preachers, our lawyers, our business people, despite all odds, their sense of self and groundedness was developed.